This is Tanek 6001 listening test. You now have 2 minutes to look at examples of different task types given after the cover page. Now the listening test begins. There are 40 questions in this test. You will have 20 seconds before each task to read the questions through. Follow closely the instructions printed in gray boxes. Listen to the tasks very carefully as you will hear them only once. Now listen to the tasks. Task 1, questions 1 and 2.
Hey, Diana, how's your new job going?
Great. I love driving those tourists around. It's one of the best jobs I've ever had.
Where did you take them today? Were you on the bus again?
Yeah, we had them on the bus, and we took them to the canyon.
Wow, that must have been great. Did you have many people with you today?
There were a few empty spaces, so the bus wasn't full.
Why was that?
I think a few people didn't feel too great today and decided to stay at the hotel. We did too many things yesterday, and a lot of people were feeling tired in the morning when we picked them up from the hotel.
Were you the only guide on the tourist group today?
No, Mark was there, and he helped me a lot. When he's not there, I have too much to do, so I really appreciate it when I'm not alone.
Task 2, questions 3 and 4.
I'm Allie Merriam in New York. Prince William turned 32 Saturday, his first birthday as a dad. Now, so much has changed for William in recent years between becoming a husband in 2011 and then a dad in 2013. But that's not all. The next 12 months will be pivotal and full of life-changing decisions and commitments as well. Now, William is at a major crossroad when it comes to his career. He gave up a long-standing role as an Air Force search and rescue pilot to, as the palace said, transition into life as a full-time royal. That meant Will could focus on issues dear to him, like animal rights, and even take courses at Cambridge University. It seems William's having some second thoughts, though, about diving fully into royal work because, well, he kind of has a long time to wait before assuming the throne. He's second in line after his father, Charles, to succeed the Queen. Now William's said to be considering a return to his love of flying as an air ambulance pilot. Now, whatever develops on the work front, William will continue to focus on being a dad and husband.
Task 3, questions 5 and 6.
Hi, I'm Mari. I'm here with Ron. Ron is from Hawaii. So, Ron, what's so special about Hawaii?
Well, Hawaii's my home, but to people not from Hawaii, I think Hawaii is famous for its nice weather. It's warm all year round. Also, it's known for its beaches. The beaches are very nice, and it's also known for its warm hospitality. The people are also very nice.
So, can you tell me more about the weather? It's always sunny. It never rains?
It does rain, but often it rains and is sunny at the same time, so we have a lot of rainbows. So Hawaii is also famous for rainbows.
That's nice. Can you tell me more about the beach?
We have beaches on all shores of the island, of all our islands, so there's many beaches to choose from. And often, some beaches have big waves, some beaches have small waves, and you can choose which beach to go to depending on whether you want to surf in big waves or you want to swim where there's no waves.
Task 4, questions 7 and 8.
My name is Noah Reed. I'm from Toronto, and I'm an actor, and I've been an actor since I was six or seven. Mostly theater and voiceover to start off my career, and gradually kind of moving into film and television. I studied at the National Theatre School of Canada. I went to high school at the Etobicoke School of the Arts. My parents are stained glass artists. And my sister's a printmaker.
What's your middle name?
My middle name is Nicholas.
How cute.
And there's nothing else about me that anyone needs to know.
That was pretty good. How do I follow that?
I don't know.
I'm Melanie Leishman. I'm a Toronto actor as well. Mm-hmm. I also started in theater when I was very young.
Oh.
Yes, I also went to an arts high school.
Huh.
Oh. There's so much in common. And I've been acting in TV and film for the last 10 years. A couple series, most recently Taught in the Book of Pure Evil. And I finished another film recently called Stage Fright. But yeah, based out of Toronto.
Task 5, questions 9 and 10.
Okay, most people are probably familiar with American money, but maybe not the faces of the money. So, let's meet the faces of the U.S. monetary system. First up, on the $1 bill is George Washington. George Washington was the first president of the United States, so fittingly, he is on the $1 bill. Before being president, he was a general in the army. Okay, next up, Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln is famous for being the president during the American Civil War. And during the Civil War, the North and South of the country fought, and Lincoln was the president. A big issue at that time was slavery. And also, Lincoln is famous for being assassinated. He was killed when he was president.
Task 6, question 11.
Today, a husband and wife are going to tell us how they met. It was Manitowoc, Wisconsin, back in 1983. Kelly Krieg had just moved to the area when Michael Sigmund caught her eye in the local tavern.
I thought you were an alcoholic. Every night, I saw you sitting at the end of the bar, hunched over what appeared to be a cup of coffee. I thought, first of all, something's going in that coffee besides coffee. And at exactly 7 minutes to 11, you headed out the door as fast as you were able. And I thought, okay, you got a bar stool somewhere else waiting for you at 11 o'clock.
I was working overnight at a radio station, and I heard your voice. I thought, I'm desperate for a date to go to the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra concert. I've run through everybody else I know, and they've all turned me down, and you ended up being number 58.
Absolutely. One of the biggest risks I've ever taken was agreeing to go out with you. But you spoke in complete sentences, and you weren't that much bigger than me, so I figured I could take you if I had to.
Task 7, questions 12 and 13.
Now, a story about something you can hear every day on our program, but that we almost never talk about. Not a single-payer healthcare system. The funding credits. That's what public radio people call our very short, simple commercials. In particular, this one.
Support for NPR comes from the estate of Richard Leroy Walters, whose life was enriched by NPR and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover public radio.
I heard that for the first time several weeks ago and wondered who Richard Leroy Walters was. Out of sheer curiosity, I Googled the name and was soon reading an article in the online newsletter of a Catholic mission in Phoenix, Arizona. Mr. Walters had remembered the mission in his will, too. It turns out he died 2 years ago at the age of 76 and left an estate of about $4 million. Now, what distinguished Mr. Walters from any number of solvent, well-to-do Americans with seven-figure estates was this. He was homeless. He was a retired engineer from Allied Signal Corporation, an honors graduate of Purdue with a master's degree, and a former Marine, never married, no children, estranged from his brother, and homeless. But not friendless. Rita Bell is a registered nurse who met Walters at a senior center 13 years ago.
He always came in with a little backpack on and a cap on and always kind of looked at me, but very reserved. And I'm very outgoing and outspoken, and so I'd say to him, hey, have you got a minute? Can you sit down and visit? And we'd have a coffee there at the senior center.
They became friends. Rita Bell stayed with him when he was ill. She became his nurse and ultimately the executor of his estate, as well as one of the beneficiaries.
Task 8, questions 14 and 15.
Staying in the Pacific, New Zealand has brought in tough new laws to try to stop graffiti. There are hefty fines for anyone caught in the act and a ban on the sale of spray cans to people under 18. The most common type of graffiti is tagging, where the writer leaves a stylized version of their signature. But some say the measures won't have any impact because tagging is a symptom of wider social problems in the country. New Zealand correspondent Kerry Ritchie reports.
Not long after I moved into my home in Auckland, I was the target of a tagger. One side of my house is now covered in big symbols and slogans in black spray paint. I've thought about painting over it, but friends say it will just provide a nice new canvas for another graffiti artist. More and more homes, shops and office buildings across New Zealand are being hit. The New Zealand government decided it was time to get tough on tagging. Before entering politics, Labor MP George Hawkins was an art teacher. He told Parliament there's nothing creative about tagging.
Task 9, questions 16 and 17.
There's a Native American site in Ohio that appeared to be a fort, but recent discoveries by archaeologists at the University of Cincinnati show that's not the case. Instead, it's a 2,000-year-old Shawnee water management system. It stretches out almost 6 kilometers. That's much larger than what had been thought to comprise the so-called fort. It's one of the largest such sites in the country. What had been thought to be gates for military protection are actually a series of dams and irrigation canals. There are logs and clay bricks for damming. Raceways for flowing water originate in far-off springs. The water was stored and channeled for irrigation. Drill cores show water sediments and clay. The site demonstrates a sophisticated knowledge of engineering, which archaeologists did not realize that Native American communities might have. The site also reveals an emphasis on public works rather than on war. So this discovery might rewrite a bit of history.
Task 10, questions 18 and 19.
The woman you're about to meet was born in Vietnam. She's been a beauty queen, a refugee, and a law enforcement officer in the U.S. Now she has a new career in another faraway land, as NPR's Michael Sullivan reports.
How many former FBI agents can claim to have been Miss Saigon? Myung Robson can.
I was Miss Saigon in 1970, and like everything else in my life, it's just like pure luck. You know, my teacher had come to tell me that, you know, we have some beauty pageant going on in town, and why don't you just try it out? The next thing I know is that I was in the finals and was crowned as Miss Saigon by the wife of the Prime Minister of South Vietnam, Madame Trần Thị Kim.
Myung Robson's road from beauty queen to FBI special agent began on April 29, 1975. Her father had recently retired as a three-star general, and the communists were closing in on Saigon.
When we saw a helicopter falling off the rooftop of one of the condominium, like a block away from our home, my mom said, "That's it, we have to leave." So we just rushed out of the house with like about $60 in my dad's pocket, clothes on our back, and it just ran to the port of Saigon.
They scrambled onto a ship and a few months later found themselves in New York as refugees, picking strawberries in Stony Brook for 15 cents a basket.
It was just heaven. You know, after having spent so much time on sea and to be able to just like lie down on the field of strawberries and eat as much as we could and then just pick whatever's left over for sale for 15 cents a basket, it was fun. It was really fun.
Task 11, question 20.
We visited the diamond this past week with the museum's gem curator, Jeffrey Post.
This, of course, is the famous Hope Diamond.
This is the famous Hope Diamond.
Tell me a little bit about how this diamond got to be here at the Museum of Natural History.
Well, the Hope Diamond was a gift to the Smithsonian Institution and therefore to the American people from Harry Winston in 1958.
Jeweler
in New York. And after the death of Evelyn Walsh McLean, a woman who lived here in Washington, D.C., and the last really private owner of the Hope Diamond, Harry Winston bought the diamond from her estate in 1949. And in 1958, he decided that the United States should have a great national gem collection. And Harry Winston was fond of saying, well, we don't have a king and queen, but we should have our crown jewels.
There's a lot of mythology around this diamond. Some of it seems quite odd. I mean, some of the people who have come into contact with the diamond have found themselves either dead a few years later or in accidents. It's called the curse, right?
Well, the curse is certainly one of the fun parts of the mythology, the stories associated with the Hope Diamond. And it seems that the whole story of a curse developed about the time that Pierre Cartier was trying to get Evelyn Walsh McLean interested in buying the diamond. And she was known to be interested in diamonds or other pieces of jewelry that had stories, that had histories associated with them. So it's pretty clear that Pierre Cartier, if he didn't completely make up the story, certainly greatly embellished the story to get her interested. And then Evelyn Walsh McLean's life itself started to add some fuel to that fire, in the sense that even though she was a very wealthy woman, you know, the queen of the social scene here in the eastern part of the United States, very well known, despite her wealth, she had a lot of unhappiness in her life.
Task 12, questions 21 and 22.
In the hit movie Slumdog Millionaire, the star answers game show questions correctly based on his life experiences. At least one right answer, however, is a lucky guess. But maybe the guess wasn't so lucky. Maybe his brain actually knew the answer, even though he didn't realize it. That's what scientists at Northwestern University are saying about so-called lucky guesses. They published their research online in the journal Nature Neuroscience. Study participants were shown brightly colored pictures. They had to memorize half. While viewing the other half, they had to concentrate on remembering a spoken number, so they were distracted. Later, they were quizzed on all the images. Surprisingly, they were more successful at remembering those images that they only paid half a mind to. Not only that, but they were more accurate when they said they were just guessing. The researchers say their visual system stored memories quite accurately, even when the participants weren't paying attention, and that what we call intuition, some of those gut feelings we get, may often be based on good information.
Task 13, question 23.
The latest media sensation in China, a father who not just beat his kids, but boasts about how he did it. Wolf Dad, as he's been nicknamed, has been doing the chat shows. He's been laying out his system for getting three of his four kids into China's top school, Peking University. 47-year-old Xiao Baiyou describes himself as the emperor of his family. As such, he's laid down an extraordinary system of rules for his children.
1,000, more than 1,000, 如果全部加起来.
I have more than 1,000 rules, specific detailed rules about how to hold your chopsticks and your bowl, how to pick up food, how to hold a cup, how to sleep, how to cover yourself with a quilt. If you don't follow the rules, then I must beat you.
What happens if you sleep the wrong way at night, I ask? Then I'll beat the child in the morning, he answers. For each violation of the rules, the penalty is to be hit with a feather duster on the legs or on the palm of the hand. If it doesn't leave a mark, then it won't make an impact, Wolf Dad believes. Never mind sleepovers, his kids weren't even allowed friends. He started beating them when they were three and stopped when they got to 12.
From 3 to 12, kids are mainly animals. Their humanity and social nature still aren't complete, so you have to use Pavlovian methods to educate them.
Task 14, question 24.
A story from Cody, Wyoming, just outside of Yellowstone National Park. That's where biologists Philip and Susan McClinton live. They had their first date 40 years ago this week, but their romance didn't begin quite the way you might imagine. The couple recently sat down to remember how they met.
I came into the topless bar that you were bouncing to compete in amateur night because there was a prize at the end. And at the time, I had two children to support, so I needed the money. I remember at one point you said, I'll keep an eye on you.
I thought, she doesn't belong in here. She didn't need to be in this place.
And I think that was the beginning of our relationship. You said, I'm going to take you rattlesnake hunting. I thought you were absolutely out of your mind. But I had so much fun, I thought, hey, this is something I might want to do on a regular basis.
Task 15, question 25.
NPR's Peter Kenyon has our story from Istanbul.
The embassy in Ankara is on a main thoroughfare in the Turkish capital, but the entrance is tucked away on a quieter side street with a standalone security checkpoint for visitors. This is where Turkish officials say the bomber detonated his device, possibly afraid of discovery. A large hole was blown into the outer wall of the checkpoint, and television footage showed rescue crews loading bodies into an ambulance. Ambassador Frank Ricciardoni made his way outside to affirm U.S. solidarity with Turkey and to offer condolences to the family of the Turkish security guard who was killed in the blast.
We are very sad, of course, that we lost one of our Turkish guards at the gate. We salute his bravery, his service to Turkey and to Turkish-American friendship. We are very sad, and we pray for the speedy recovery of the wounded person, also a Turkish citizen.
Turkish media say the wounded woman is a Turkish journalist reported to be in critical condition. As speculation began to swirl about who may have been behind the attack, a Kurdish, Syrian, Islamist militant, Turkey's interior minister identified the bomber as a 30-year-old member of a left-wing radical group.
Task 16, question 26.
Travelling is a very troublesome business, advised Charles Dickens' Household Words magazine in 1852. According to the accounts drawn from letters, diaries and public sources in this compendium of facts, figures and travellers' tales from the 19th century, he was right. What with the lack of cutlery, clean sheets, hot water for tea and baths, the constant threat of arrest, assault or robbery, the menacing presence of mustachioed foreigners and the state of the lavatories, it's surprising that the British ever embarked on foreign travel at all. However, they did, and on a scale that astonished their hosts. In the 100 years between the fall of Napoleon and the outbreak of the First World War, travel became one of the great boom industries of the age. Using records carefully amassed by the French police and port authorities, Richard Mullen and James Munson estimate that fewer than 10,000 people travelled from Britain to the continent in 1814. By the 1860s, the figure had grown to a quarter of a million each year.
Task 17, questions 27 and 28.
English language publications aimed at expatriates and tourists have been common for years. But the new development involves big, established national journals whose bosses want to be more visible in English. Der Spiegel, a German news weekly, has founded a pan-European network linking up such websites. A Dutch daily, NRC Handelsblad, joined a few months ago, followed by Politiken from Denmark. The trio are in talks with newspapers in France and Spain. They are eager to expand into Eastern Europe, though the credit crunch is likely to slow progress. An online English edition can cost €500,000 a year in translation fees. Beyond this network, a non-exhaustive trawl finds English language websites of big newspapers in Germany, Italy, Finland, Greece, Spain, Romania, Poland, Bulgaria and Turkey. Many are recent ventures. Editors' motives are a mix of idealism and commercial ambition. Bosses at Spiegel have a political dream to create a platform where Europeans can read what other Europeans think about the world, says Daryl Lindsay, who runs the magazine's international edition. But an English presence is also a calling card when pitching to international advertisers. It has proved helpful to journalists seeking interviews with world leaders. The evidence points to the imminent collapse of the European Union's official language policy, known as Mother Tongue Plus Two, in which citizens are encouraged to learn two foreign languages as well as their own. That is, please learn something besides English. Among Europeans born before the Second World War, English, French and German are almost equally common. But according to a Eurobarometer survey, 15 to 24-year-olds are five times more likely to speak English as a foreign language than either German or French. Add native speakers to those who have learnt it, and some 60% of young Europeans speak English, well or very well.
Task 18, questions 29 and 30.
Clinical depression is a serious ailment, but almost everyone gets mildly depressed from time to time. Randolph Nesse, a psychologist and researcher in evolutionary medicine at the University of Michigan, likens the relationship between mild and clinical depression to the one between normal and chronic pain. He sees both pain and low mood as warning mechanisms and thinks that just as understanding chronic pain means first understanding normal pain, so understanding clinical depression means understanding mild depression. Dr. Nesse's hypothesis is that as pain stops you doing damaging physical things, so low mood stops you doing damaging mental ones, in particular, pursuing unreachable goals. Pursuing such goals is a waste of energy and resources. Therefore, he argues, there is likely to be an evolved mechanism that identifies certain goals as unattainable and inhibits their pursuit, and he believes that low mood as at least part of that mechanism. It is a neat hypothesis, but is it true? A study published in this month's issue of the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology suggests it might be.
Task 19, question 31.
It's been an interesting challenge with The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas. It's a good film, but it's not a historically accurate film. And there has certainly been debates between those that teach history and those that teach citizenship about its value. I personally would not describe it necessarily as a film about the Holocaust. I see The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas as a film about growing up. So it's actually a fable, and it is a fable that could be set in different scenarios. It could have been set on a slave ship. It could have been set in a Victorian workhouse. It's a fable about growing up. And certainly, as a Holocaust film, it does present difficulties historically because there are things there that simply could not have happened. But I know it's been a very popular film. I know it's been very well received when it came out. And the book also was very well received by Holocaust survivors as well. And I've spoken to a lot of survivors and children of survivors as well about the book. But I think one has to be aware that although it's a representation, it's not real, it couldn't have happened, I do think, as you said earlier, Toby, it will engage curiosity, particularly among young boys that, again, can identify with those two boys, that can relate to them. And if they want to find out more and they want to find out what actually did happen, that's good.
Task 20, question 32.
In many countries, full jails, stretched budgets, and a general weariness with the war on drugs have made prohibition harder to enforce.
The Green Relief Natural Health Clinic in a bohemian part of San Francisco doesn't sound like an ordinary doctor's surgery. For those who wonder about the sort of relief provided, its logo, a cannabis leaf, is a clue. Inside, in under an hour and for $99, patients can get a doctor's letter allowing them to smoke marijuana in California with no fear of prosecution. In a state that pioneered bans on smoking tobacco, smoking cannabis is now easier than almost anywhere in the world. California, with its network of pot-friendly physicians, offers the most visible evidence of a tentative worldwide shift towards a more liberal policy on drugs. Although most countries remain bound by a trio of United Nations conventions that prohibit the sale and possession of narcotics, laws are increasingly being bent or ignored. That is true even in the United States, where the Obama administration has announced that registered cannabis dispensaries will no longer be raided by federal authorities.
Task 21, question 33.
They are not the world's most effusive people at the best of times. But even by their usual gloomy standards, Britons seem to have got themselves into a slough of despond of late. Well before the economic crisis, they were weeping on the shoulders of pollsters, who reported rapidly rising levels of dismay about the country's direction and an increased sense of nostalgia about the good old days. For those, and they are legion on inner-city council estates as well as in the shires, who think that society in Britain is broken, the country is stuck in a mire of crime, fractured families, and feral youth. It's an idea that resonates. Every week serves up a new tragedy or outrage to be added to the pile of evidence. The vomitous binge drinking mainly by the young, the drug abuse and teenage pregnancy that are still higher than in most West European countries, and the large proportion of single-parent families all tell a tale. But the story of broad decline is simply untrue. Stepping back from the glare of the latest appalling tale, it is clear that by most measures, things have been getting better for a good decade and a half. In suggesting that the rot runs right through society, the Tories fail to pinpoint the areas where genuine crises persist. The broken Britain myth is worse than scaremongering. It glosses over those who need help most.
Task 22, questions 34 and 35.
That the children of the poor underachieve in later life and thus remain poor themselves is one of the enduring problems of society. Sociologists have studied and described it. Socialists have tried to abolish it by dictatorship and central planning. Liberals have preferred democracy and opportunity. But nobody has truly understood what causes it, until perhaps now. The crucial breakthrough was made 3 years ago, when Martha Farah of the University of Pennsylvania showed that the working memories of children who've been raised in poverty have smaller capacities than those of middle-class children. Working memory is the ability to hold bits of information in the brain for current use, the digits of a phone number, for example. It's crucial for comprehending languages, for reading, and for solving problems. Entry into the working memory is also a prerequisite for something to be learnt permanently as part of declarative memory, the stuff a person knows explicitly, like the dates of famous battles, rather than what he knows implicitly, like how to ride a bicycle. Since Dr. Farah's discovery, Gary Evans and Michelle Schamberg of Cornell University have studied the phenomenon in more detail. As they report in this week's Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, they've found that the reduced capacity of the memories of the poor is almost certainly the result of stress affecting the way that childish brains develop. To measure the amount of stress an individual had suffered over the course of his life, the two researchers used an index known as allostatic load.
Task 23, questions 36 and 37.
Good morning. More news today of the effects of the global credit crunch. As we all know, the cause of the crisis goes back to the selling of subprime mortgages, complex long-term loans aimed at the poor, who grasped at them gratefully only to find that they were trapped in debt they couldn't repay. British bank bosses are hoping today to find new ways to reassure investors worried about losing their precious savings. There's been much criticism of the American banks for their lending policies, suggesting that these were not only unwise but unjust. One financial reporter yesterday described the selling of subprime loans as predatory. The debt was designed to go on and on. All this reminded me of the story in the book of Genesis about what happened when ancient Egypt was struck by famine. First, the starving people sold all their cattle and got food handouts in exchange. Then they had to sell their land and got seed to sow on fields that, of course, no longer belonged to them. They became bonded labourers, slaves, and it was as slaves of Pharaoh that the Hebrew people faced further oppression when their growing numbers began to pose a threat. The thrust of the story in the Bible is that the original enslavement was unjust. No one should be forced to sell themselves in this way. Being in debt is an ancient Christian metaphor for the whole human condition. The early Christians believed that we're lured into moral debt by the false promises of the devil, who exploits our appetite for security, pleasure and power. So we all end up enslaved in one way or another.
Task 24, question 38.
Why this book now?
Well, partly because I wasn't ready to write it earlier. Mm. I felt I'm not emotionally in the right place to write it, really. Also, I felt I wanted to slam the door on the past and get on with my life for a long time. And I just thought I would wait until I felt objective enough, detached enough, until there was enough distance. And I think I finally reached that point, so that's why.
When you were writing the Satanic Verses, were you aware that it would be at least provocative?
Well, I mean, I thought probably some sort of conservative, orthodox, religious people wouldn't like it. You know, But, I mean, they hadn't liked anything else I'd written either. So, I mean, that wasn't really a factor. I mean, I think, you know, my view was and is that nothing's off limits. You know, that when you start writing about the stuff which is the central experience of your own life anyway, you know, you can talk about whatever you want, you know, and you can talk about it in whatever way you want.
So you find yourself in a truly extraordinary position, which you couldn't have predicted, you couldn't have imagined, you couldn't have wished for, certainly. No. What was that like?
It was frightening at times, and a lot of the fear was not only for me, because remember, I mean, I was worried about my family, and it was very disorienting. It was very hard to know how to act.
Task 25, questions 39 and 40.
Singer, songwriter, and an activist for homeless youth. Welcome, Jewel.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. In June, you testified before a hearing at the House Ways and Means Subcommittee as an ambassador for Virgin United. What were you able to accomplish when you spoke there?
Together with the help of Virgin Mobile USA and Virgin Unite, we sort of launched an effort called the Regeneration. And we all went to D.C. to try and get November passed as National Homeless Youth Awareness Month, and we were successful, we're really happy to say. So now we're just trying to spread the word about the issues.
How can people get involved in helping with this cause?
There's actually a website you can go to that's homelessyouthamongus.org if you want to figure out how to get involved in your local community. Really, it's just letting people know that this is an issue. Homeless youth are very invisible. Their greatest skill is blending in. And gosh, there's over 1 million kids that are on the street. I was homeless myself for a year, so it's something I know about, and I know how hard it is and how tragic most kids' lives end. 13 kids die a day, actually, on the street, so it's a serious issue.
What are some of the other consequences of growing up homeless for children?
You know, we really learn how to live in the world from adults, and that's a process that really happens from age 8 on. You're never taught that. You know, I didn't know about how to anything. I didn't know how anything functioned. I didn't know about systems. I didn't even know how to help myself. And there are organizations out there like Stand Up for Kids that are trying to teach kids how to get out, how to first month last rent, things that everybody takes for granted that they learn just from being in a family.
What's some advice that you would give to people on the streets right now, given everything that you've gone through and how you're able to pull yourself up and out of it?
For me, what I battled most was not becoming so bitter that I couldn't look for positive opportunities. You're so forgotten, and you're so scared, and you're so helpless that losing hope becomes very easy. I think the best thing I did was I never did get involved in drugs, and I tried to keep my chin up and work hard and remain tenacious and positive, and those things are really important to surviving.
This is the end of STANAG 6001 listening test. You now have 1 minute to transfer your answers onto the answer sheet.